As we're approaching the weekend, it's that time of the week to find out what's on at the cinema. During today's show, I'll get to grips with the latest silver screen releases with a little help from film critic Jason Solomons. Up for discussion today, we have an off-key opera in Marguerite, a stunning documentary set in Patagonia called The Pearl Button, and we'll find out what terrors might lurk above the basement in 10 Cloverfield Lane. That's all to come on today's edition of the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Stay tuned. Now, we don't mean to start the show off on a bum note, but the protagonist of our first film isn't known for quite hitting the right key. Marguerite tells the story of a woman in 1920s Paris with a passion for the opera. She loves to perform for her friends and is desperate to sing in front of a real audience, but the only problem is she can't sing. Well, on that sour note, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the intro. Even I can follow that.
Now, the singing may be a little off-key, and yet critics have seemed to love this film.
I tell you what, I was worried about just hearing that, because when you see it and see the actress Catherine Frotte throw herself into this with gusto, it's hilarious, I have to say. So, especially at the beginning, where she's gathered all this kind of salon to her kind of, you know, stately pile outside Paris, and all the great, and they're clapping because she's the sort of wealthy landowner kind of lady, and so they're all kind of fawning in front of her, and no one wants to sort of tell her that she can't sing. So she kind of belts this out, and it's very difficult to sing just that little bit off key. I think you have to be a very skilled singer to do it, although the joke is that of course she's not. And then of course there's, because this is 1920s France, there's some Dadaists about and some Surrealists, and they think it's really a hell of a wheeze to kind of put her in a proper salon in Paris and have her sing like this. They think it's kind of genius. And of course then she gets very disappointed by the fact that you know, people are booing and hurling tomatoes at her, which is kind of what happened in those kind of Dadaist salons in Paris. So I think that it gets that right. And of course, then it becomes a very delusional tale of this woman who really believes she can sing and that she has got this wonderful voice and does build up to this opera. And she gets an opera coach and he tries to kind of save her. And then she becomes almost like a deluded opera heroine in a way. All she wants to do is impress her husband, who kind of tries to everything to get out of attending one of her recitals. He'll try and get his car to break down. He'll try to get any excuse not to be there to face up to the fact that he doesn't really love this woman. It becomes very sad. I think it's a really brilliant film, Marguerite. I really enjoyed it. It's very funny and then quickly becomes sort of different. And the bit we heard there, her singing is very funny, I think, at the start. And then she does it again later. And it's absolutely tragic. And I think that's a brilliant juxtaposition.
It seems rather improbable that someone with a love of opera and music can sing so badly and yet be unaware of it. But what is the origins? I gather there is some truth in this story.
There is some truth in the story, although it's not a French story. It's actually based on a high society New York lady called Florence Foster Jenkins. Now, you may think, I've heard of that name, because shortly she will be played by Meryl Streep in a Stephen Frears biopic of that same name, on which this Marguerite is based. Now, it's interesting because you've got these two stories coming out at the same time. Marguerite, very successful at the César this year for its actress Catherine Frotte, and I think it won best movie as well. It's a great French story, very different to the one that Florence Foster Jenkins will be, but you've got this sort of same thing, that this kind of, you know, this grande dame who can't sing. It's going to be interesting to see what Stephen Frears does with the same story. Giannoli, who directed it, Xavier Giannoli, is very good on this sort of thing. He did a great film called The Singer or Chanteur with Gérard Depardieu as a great lounge singer who's kind of on his uppers at the end of his career, one of the great late Gérard Depardieu performances. So this kind of backstage kind of delusional performer thing is something that Giannoli has intuits very well, and they're both excellent films. I mean, a great double bill that would be, Le Chanteur and Marguerite together. I thought it was excellent.
When you have opera sung so badly, the performances are so key, because you have to have compassion, I think, to keep the audience with the film. What was she like as an actress?
Catherine Frotte is tremendous in this. She's got that softness. She's also got a bit of, you know, there's a kind of the joy of the film, the kind of terror of the film, is that she's not far. She's like a key shift away from greatness. She thinks she's great, and she could have been great. There's something about her, this character that she plays. She kind of takes photos of herself in all the great roles as Brunhilde or as Juliet, and these photos are sort of done by this sort of kindly lackey who kind of keeps the dream alive for her, and she's got all these photos in black and white, beautifully done on her mantelpiece. So people think she's kind of performed the great roles in the great opera houses, but of course she hasn't. It's all in her head, and that, so her arc follows that of the great sort of tragic heroines in opera who are deluded and just want to, their husband to love them, but they can't. It's a really smart film. This, I have to say, it's probably going to be smarter than the Stephen Frears one. I haven't seen that one, so I don't want to do it down. But it's got a very different timbre to it because it's kind of about sort of fantasy. So it's a bit more of a fantasy than a biopic. And the actress has us in her palm of her hand. I mean, and really tragically, because you really want her to do well, but she can't. So that's the heartbreak.
Well, do check it out. Marguerite is released in the UK today and is already showing at cinemas in Japan and the USA, amongst others, around the world. Now, over the past few weeks on our film review, we've discussed a wealth of horror flicks and sinister psycho thrillers that are being released at the moment. Well, to add to this list is 10 Cloverfield Lane, a sort of sequel to the 2008 film Cloverfield. Jason, can you explain the premise of this film?
Yes, well, as you say, it's a sort of sequel to the Cloverfield that J.J. Abrams made. This is the guy who went on to make Star Wars, of course, now the world's biggest filmmaker, of course. But he started out with a low-budget sci-fi called Cloverfield, in which kind of partying Manhattanites on a roof terrace were kind of, you know, scattered by the arrival of an alien invasion. And it was all told on that. Do you remember found footage? That little kind of penchant the cinema had for found footage, where it was a dropped video camera and everyone go, oh, look at what happened. Is it true? So this is part of the Cloverfield verse, I think they call it, the Cloververse, the sort of universe that people like to create with their films now, so they can endlessly roll out franchises till Kingdom Come. Well, Kingdom has come in Cloverfield, because the young sort of heroine of this, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, kind of finds herself run off the road, and she wakes up after her crash in a bunker, in a room, rather like we had recently in the Oscar-nominated Room. She's in a room, she's held captive, chained up by a nasty John Goodman. Nasty John Goodman. John Goodman's always nice. Not in 10 Cloverfield Lane, he isn't.
Let's have a listen to a clip from 10 Cloverfield Lane.
No! No! No, no! No! Don't open that door! They're going to get all of us killed!
Something's coming.
A clip from the movie 10 Cloverfield Lane. Tell us a little bit about the director and how he does with horror.
Yeah, it's Dan Trachtenberg. He's a first-time filmmaker. I've never really heard of him before. And I think no one really heard about this film being made. It sort of snuck out. J.J. Abrams producing a Cloverfield sequel. And a lot of people will be listening to that. They've sort of snuck it out and done it in secret. But you can see how they've done it, because it's about an underground bunker that we heard John Goodman yelling her not to open the door because he's got her captive. And he says, well, I've made you safe, really, because outside you can't go there, the air's contaminated, there's been an attack, no one's alive. We don't know if that's true or not. Is he just a sort of serial killer keeping her captive there, or is that really true outside? Occasionally she looks outside and, you know, there's some people, there's almost a sort of zombie trips across the screen, and you think, well, maybe it's true. So it becomes an escape movie and a captor movie and a sort of living underground movie, and then she does try and sort of wiggle free at various moments, but can she get out? Does she want to get out? What's going to be waiting for her when she does get out there? So that's the main tension of the movie, and it's kind of an interplay between Mary Elizabeth Winstead and John Goodman, who plays this kind of deluded guy, Howard, again, slightly deluded, but he might not be. He talks about his daughter, and he talks about the past and how everyone out there, and he saved her, and this other guy who's down there too. You know, it's very, people have sort of said Hitchcockian, because it's just some people in a room. And Trachtenberg does that well to keep it going. Eventually, you do see the bigger picture. And for me, when you talk about monsters, they're always much more scary in the imagining than when you see them. And I do say you do see something of that, as you did in the original Cloverfield. And it's a bit of a letdown, to be honest, but the stuff in the room, in the bunker, really good.
I gather, or I heard, it was all filmed sequence. sequentially. Is that true? And if so, what does it add to the telling of the story?
Yeah, it's very hard to tell that because, I mean, there's sort of various scenes where there's a bit of talking, trying to fill time. I felt there was a little bit of baggage in this. It's not the longest film in the world either, but there were scenes where sort of Mary Elizabeth Winston and the other captive are sort of talking about their childhood, and that was all a bit dull, to be honest with you. I didn't really care. The chasing around, trying to escape, the kind of John Goodman going after you with a barrel of acid, that bit's all good. Whether it was filmed sequentially, you couldn't really tell, to be honest with you. I do like a film that is filmed sequentially, but actually in the edit, you always wonder, you know, did it edit sequentially? Do they kind of put bit together? The tension does ratchet up, I have to say. And even though I always felt manipulated, whenever a girl in a vest is trying to kind of squeeze through a tight kind of, you know, vent, I'm always going, oh, go on, is she going to get it? Is he going to catch it? Oh. So it did get me in the end.
Well, do head to the cinemas to see 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is out in the UK, Ireland and Spain today, and is rolling out in cinemas around the world throughout the next month or so. Our final film today is a documentary by Patricio Guzman that uses water as a starting point to tell a beautifully shot story of human history. Set in Patagonia, it looks at the recent and distant history of some of the people who live here to contemplate such things as our existence in the universe and Chile's political past. Let's hear a clip from the documentary.
Mirando las estrellas, me atrajo la importancia del agua. Parece que el agua vino del espacio exterior y que la vida nos llegó en los cometas que formaron los mares.
A clip from the documentary The Pearl Button. Now, there are so many themes woven in this documentary, but what was the main premise?
Yeah, as you can hear there, even from my rudimentary Spanish, it's about the comets and the stars and how they connect to water. Guzman, who recently did a documentary called Nostalgia for the Light, which was set in the Atacama Desert, which is, of course, in the top of Chile. He now sort of moves down to the very bottom of Chile. I was going to say north and south, but I'm always a bit confused by that hemisphere. So it's right at the bottom of Chile now, in the Tierra del Fuego area, Patagonia, which is more like fjord land, and it's got the world's largest
eerie turquoise,
beautiful seas and icebergs, but cold seas, and there used to be tribes that lived there who'd never been touched by human hands, white settlers. Eventually Captain Fitzroy sailed on the Beagle before Darwin took it further round to the Galapagos. The Beagle got down to there and sort of met these guys, and he traded one native for a pearl button, hence the name of the title. A guy called became known as Jemmy Button was brought back to Victorian England and made sort of Christianized and anglicized, and then brought back to Tierra del Fuego, where he could never quite readjust to his kind of former native self. That's a fascinating story. And Guzman tells that story, but it becomes linked to another button that he finds at the bottom of the sea, which is connected to a body from the Pinochet era of Desaparecidos, the disappeared. And Guzman does this all the time in his documentaries. He connects political past to the cosmos and the behaviour of Chile, which is this kind of sort of strip of land with this coastline that goes from the Arctic to the desert in the north. It's an extraordinary kind of fabric, if you like, that he weaves, as you mentioned, weaving all these things, that you can kind of go back from the earliest settlers to indigenous, to the water drops that are in the rocks that go back 3,000 years and connected to the stars and how water moves among the rocks and tells a story. Even till today, it's still bringing up stories from the past, washing up these dead bodies from the Pinochet regime onto the shores. I found it completely mesmerising and hypnotic and absolutely cosmic in a way. I mean, and literally cosmic. And I say that like an old hippie. But it was like you're contemplating the earth and the stars and the connection in between and how we humans are part of that. And I think sometimes we forget in our urban lives to connect to those landscapes. But really, sometimes those kind of elemental forces that work are very difficult to catch in cinema. And Guzman does it brilliantly with that wonderful narration that he's got going as well. And it does all connect. And by the end of it, I was completely enraptured by history, by the stars, and our brief time on this planet.
We are radio, so I am going to ask you to describe visually the look and the production values of the storytelling.
Yes, I mean, often with documentaries, you think, well, do I want to go to the cinema to see this? And I think with something like Guzman's work, yes, you absolutely have to. It's beautiful time-lapse photography of water, that wonderful turquoise glaciers that you describe, but also that cold water winding through the green forests of Patagonia, the snows of Patagonia. don't you? The beauty of the stars and the desert that he gets, and the beauty of the sea that he gets as well. Some of it's very interesting. He then even kind of reconstructs one of Pinochet's death camps and the kind of way they used to dispose of bodies, and reenacts that with a dummy body, of course. And even that's kind of thrillingly done as well. So for me, it was very much a kind of cinematic experience that you want to ponder. I'd like to see it even bigger. I'd like to see it in the planetarium or somewhere like that. And also with a rather rapt audience. You know, sometimes cinemas like going to to church or synagogue or temple or something. There's mm-hmm. a religious experience.
Communal.
And a communal kind of feeling there. I mean, it's very much about that. And I thought that, for me, that's why this one, The Pearl Button, is the film of the week.
The Pearl Button premiered at last year's Berlin International Film Festival, where it won the Silver Bear Award for the best script. It has since been released around Europe and hits UK cinemas today and Italian ones next month. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to my guest, Jason Solomons. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. The show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mari Justi. Don't forget to tune into the cinema show this evening at 20:00 hours UK time, when we'll be hearing from High Rise director Ben Wheatley. We'll be back at the same time on Monday to see what's happening in the art world here in London. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.